ABC News Radio. I'm Mike Vaccara at the White House. Emergencies have been declared in Maryland, West Virginia, Ohio, the District of Columbia, and Virginia in the wake of Friday's deadly storms. Hundreds of thousands are without electricity, and Ken Barker of Dominion Power in Virginia says it could be days before the juice is back on for everyone.
We've got a lot of work to do. Just to put this storm in perspective, it is the largest restoration effort of a non-hurricane in our 100-year history.
Gas lines are also a problem, as many stations are without power.
It's been this way all day. Lines.
The outages are especially dangerous because they've left the region without air conditioning during an oppressive heat wave. Some of the people who fled the most destructive fire in Colorado's history will confront the reality of their burned-out homes when they're temporarily allowed back into devastated neighborhoods today. The fire near Colorado Springs destroyed nearly 350 homes. This is NBC News Radio. They're voting to pick a new president in Mexico today. NBC's Mark Potter has details about the frontrunner.
Leading in the polls in the presidential race is 45-year-old Enrique Peña Nieto, a telegenic former governor from the party known as the PRI. The PRI led Mexico for seven straight decades until it was voted out 12 years ago amid allegations of widespread corruption and cronyism.
The 45-year-old has pledged to reduce drug-fueled violence. Polls show he has a double-digit lead over his two opponents. Wedding bells were in the air for an often outspoken actor.
30 rock star Alec Baldwin is a married man once again. The 54-year-old took 28-year-old Hilaria Thomas as his wife as they tied the knot at the Basilica of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral in Manhattan. Baldwin's 16-year-old daughter with ex-wife Kim Basinger was in attendance, along with Jimmy Fallon, Tina Fey, Woody Allen, and Alec's brothers Billy and Steven. Barbara Cusack, NBC News Radio.
I'm Mike Vaccara, NBC News Radio.
Get in the zone!
Keeping an engine running clean and efficient is the best way to help maximize mileage, and regular oil changes are the best way to do it. Now at AutoZone, get a 5-plus quart jug of Pennzoil conventional motor oil and a Fram Extra Guard oil filter for just $21.99. Or upgrade to Pennzoil high mileage oil for just a few dollars more. See store for restrictions and details. And for more gas saving tips, get to AutoZone today. Parts are just part of what we do.
Get in the zone!
AutoZone.
It was the moment I realized I was about to lose my job.
I found myself searching for pills instead of just being with my family.
At that moment, I finally decided to get help for my addiction to opioids.
The prescription painkillers.
At TurnToHelpNow.com, you'll learn that opioid dependence is a real medical condition and that there are different ways to get help, including those in a private setting without the need for daily visits.
That moment led me to TurnToHelpNow.com.
Make now your moment. Visit TurnToHelpNow.
Hi, welcome to Best Buy. How can I help you?
Yeah, I already have the little Insignia HD Radio Portable that I use at the gym, but I thought I saw a new one on HDRadio.com that I could use on my desk. Is that right?
You bet. It's only $49, and just like the Portable, it has HD Radio technology, so you can get the new HD2, HD3 channels.
Great. So for under $50, I can get Insignia's new table radio with both digital sound and the extra channels?
Yep. Plus, it works with batteries.
Sweet. So I can take it to the pool and the beach this summer. Sold.
HD Radio. More radio, more value.
Soon, this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible.
March for Babies!
Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
And I can just read on the plane without any problem. Like now, when I'm on the airplane and somebody has a Kindle, they either have to turn on the light because a Kindle doesn't have any light built into it, or they also have these little small lights that clamp onto the side of the Kindle that lights it up because the Kindle is not a backlit screen. On the other hand, when I go to the swimming pool and there's bright sunlight, I cannot use the iPad.
Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on 1500 AM at 10 o'clock AM. Please join me this week for my special guest, Marissa Levin, CEO of Information Experts and author of Built to Scale, How Top Companies Create Breakthrough Growth Through Exceptional Advisory Boards. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Joseph Kampf, who's the chairman and CEO of Covant, Peter Jablow, the president and CEO of the Levine School of Music, Leo Fox, president and CEO of Tenacity Solutions, and Suzanne Jackson, the CEO of Dominion Hospital. First up is a young man by the name of Joseph Kampf, who's the chairman and CEO of a company called Covant. What is Covant, Joseph?
Covant is an investment firm founded by myself and five partners who were part of Antion International's senior executive leadership team.
When you say an investment firm, what do you look for in the way of an investment?
We look for opportunities in the government technology space, companies that need help in figuring out what their positioning in the marketplace should be, what their strategy should be, and how do you execute a growth strategy for a small to medium-sized company.
When was the company founded? The
company was founded in mid-2006.
And how big or small are you today?
We own a company. We've actually purchased four companies and put them together over the last few years. That company now is approaching 1,000 employees and more than $200 million in annual revenue.
So I know of Antion and how successful that company was. Why just not go down to Florida and ride a boat?
Oh, it's just not in me. It's not in my DNA. We did buy a home in Bermuda. My wife's been there several months so far this year, but I've only been there a week.
What makes it so exciting to stay in the game and now help companies get bigger?
I think it's partly my DNA. I really enjoy seeing people succeed and helping them in that endeavor. It's very satisfying to help people figure out what they should be doing in life, how they might be doing it successfully, and benefiting from it after all of their hard work.
So you have a pretty interesting track record, starting with Antion. Tell us a little bit about that.
Antion was purchased in 1996 by myself and an equity partner in New York called CI Capital Partners. We bought the company when it was about $100 million in revenue and about 900 employees. I ran it as CEO for 11 years, but at the end of 6 years and three quarters of a million in revenue, we took it public on the New York Stock Exchange. The next 4 years, we were able to grow the company from three quarters of a billion to $1.7 billion. And in 2006, General Dynamics bought it for $2.3 billion.
And prior to that, what were you doing?
I had an interesting career. The last 40 years, I've worked with singularly very wealthy individuals. And this is turns out to be a super way to learn how to invest in the world and what's meaningful and what isn't, and how do you get people to work together and create value.
Well, so, tell us a little bit more about specifically the experience in Brazil.
I started in 1972 with a man called D.K. Ludwig, Daniel K. Ludwig, who's now deceased, who in the 1950s acquired more than 3.5 million acres of Amazonian jungle and decided that he wanted to build a major industrial enterprise in the most remote part of the world. Quite an objective, I guess. And we were very successful. I worked there almost 10 years. We spent $1 billion in the Amazon. We built an industrial complex, a tree farm, a forest products company, supported 25,000 employees. And when I left the last year I was there, we sold the company. Mr. Ludwig was in his 80s and unable to continue to work. We sold the company to the Brazilian government.
Why do you suppose he had you run it?
Oh, I was just lucky, I guess.
Oh, come on.
Well, it's an interesting question. I think I had the drive, certainly. It was an enormous challenge. I was newly married. I had only been married three months, and my father had passed away 3 months before that. So I looked at it as something that I could embrace and that would eat up my energy in a very interesting and challenging environment, and I thought I could learn a lot from it.
What was it like to go into a totally new place like Brazil and start a company?
It was scary. I was a young kid from Manhattan in New York City who'd never been to Brazil or South America, for that matter. I did have experience with my dad setting up a business in the computer training school business, and we ran that for 5 years until he passed away. So I had some experience outside of the U.S., and I think that helped me get the spot. But nevertheless, it was very imposing going to the Amazon on my first trip. And when I came back, I told my wife I was away 2 weeks, couldn't communicate with her. And I came back and I said, that was unbelievable, but I'm never going back. And I went back every 2 weeks for the next 8 years.
Looking back on it, what was the toughest thing you accomplished?
I think that sounds like a tough question, but for me, it's probably pretty easy. I had a very senior executive team in Brazil and in New York running this project and overseeing the a big spend. I had an indigenous group of native Brazilians who were running the finance and accounting and administrative part of the project in Brazil, in the jungle. I had a treasury and finance group in Rio that reported to me, Rio de Janeiro. And then I had all of the technical people who were actually building the forest products company. So forestry geneticists, manufacturing people, et cetera. Getting all those people to work together to create a set of objectives that could be executed successfully was quite a task. And I think right there I cut my teeth on how to get people, how to lead people or get other people to lead and work together to accomplish a common objective.
So that MBA program in leadership, what would you say about your leadership style? How did that shape the way you lead?
It definitely taught me to be collegial and team-based. I don't think a great CEO at the end of the day can say that they did anything all by themselves. Basically, it's a question of getting other people to become leaders and to participate in this, either in developing the strategy or executing it.
Joseph, I understand you got a degree in economics from the University of North Carolina. How did you get from Manhattan to North Carolina?
I actually took a diversion, and my freshman year, I went to Peoria, Illinois, to Bradley University, hoping to play basketball. But due to an injury, I was unable to join the team, and I found myself in the dead of winter in Peoria, Illinois, and that wasn't a good thing. So I had a good friend at UNC in Chapel Hill, and he talked me into transferring, and that was probably the best thing I ever did.
Talk about growing up in Manhattan. What was that like?
Manhattan was great. I mean, everybody knows either has been to Manhattan and enjoyed it or knows of it. It's a great city, but it's a very fast-paced city. It's a very competitive city. I think you learn a lot about yourself growing up in an environment like that, and I think it helps
what
people
did you
shape.
Learn about yourself?
Oh, I learned that I'm aggressive. I didn't know that when I was in school. I was just sort of the nice guy that had a lot of friends and played sports. I loved sports. Which is another good attribute for training people for life in the big corporate environment. But I think I learned in New York that it's important not to be just an individual and not to just be successful. To accomplish those things, you have to be a team player.
And what was your dad doing when you were young?
Oh, my dad My dad was an advertising executive, and if for those of you who are listening who remember the cigarette sign in Times Square that blew out the puffs of smoke, my dad put it there.
Is that right?
It was his idea, and I never forgot that. But he was a wonderful guy who really, not only in just raising his kids right, but and my mom as well, but really taught us what are the cultural boundaries beyond which it's not appropriate to cross or step over. How do you operate successfully in the right way? And I'll probably never forget that as long as I live.
I understand that you were close to your grandparents, too. In what way were you shaped by them?
Well, my my parents on my mom's side lived with us for probably the last 5 or 7 years of their lives. And they were, it was easy to see from then where my mom became, you know, this great woman who spent or devoted her whole life to her family, because they were the sweetest, nicest people. And I remember my grandfather, who smoked from the time he was 7, and he passed away at 81, never wasted anything, including the cigarette that he smoked, which was a Camel cigarette, so it had no filter, and he used to smoke it down to the last little shred of paper until it evaporated, and then he would light up another one. But he never wasted any piece of that cigarette.
I know you had mentioned in the green room that your father died while you were young. If he was here, would he be surprised if I was interviewing him at your success?
I think he'd be... that's a great question. Yes, I think he would be stunned. I was about to say he'd be stunned, and I think he would be stunned. He knew we had a very close relationship until I was in my 20s and he passed away. But I think what I've been able to accomplish based on his foundation was pretty remarkable.
What's the website address, Joseph?
www.covant.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Joseph Kampf, who's the chairman and CEO of Covant. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment after this business spotlight. Good afternoon. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is...
John Adams.
And John, what company are you with?
Pingtone Communications.
What is Pingtone Communications?
We are a service provider providing a hosted voice over IP service to business customers.
And what makes your business special?
Well, we provide a highly reliable and quality service to business customers where what we're doing today is unparalleled to a lot of the other service providers that have not been in our space as long. We've been doing this since 1999, catering to the Metro DC market.
Is there a particular success story you like to reference in these situations?
We do a lot of work overseas with the troops that need to communicate back home to their families, morale, welfare, recreation. That's a small part of our business, but it's a part that's important to us. That's communication actually over satellite. So it's been pretty rewarding, that aspect of our business.
Great. What do you enjoy most about the job?
I enjoy bringing solutions to customers that have an impact on some of the things that they're trying to accomplish in their business. And you know, seeing those ideas and the things that we provide allow them or enable them to realize those benefits.
Wonderful. And how can someone reach you?
www.pingtone.com.
Wonderful. This has been John Adams with Pingtone Communications, and this is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, bringing you your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host, and I'm joined by David Taylor, who's with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a gentleman by the name of Peter Jablow, the president and CEO of the Levine School of Music. What is the Levine School of Music, Peter?
The Levine School of Music is the Greater Washington Area's preeminent center for music and music education. We have 4 campuses in the region, 3,500 students, 150 faculty, and have been around for about 36 years.
So, and on the website, it's characterized as the largest community music school in the area. What does that mean, really?
There are about 400 to 450 community music schools in the country. And we are one of the largest in the country, probably about the fifth largest. And the community music school world is quite simply institutions that provide music education to anybody, no matter your age, no matter your skill level, and no matter your income. We're here to bring music to the general public, whoever wants it.
Where are you located?
Our main campus is in Northwest D.C. On Upton Street, right off of Connecticut. We have a second campus in D.C. in Anacostia, at a wonderful place called the ARC, which stands for Town Hall Educational Arts and Recreation Campus, and that's on Mississippi Avenue in Anacostia. We are at the Westover Baptist Church at the corner of Patrick Henry and Washington Boulevard in Arlington, Virginia.
Yeah.
And we're at the Music Center at Strathmore in North Bethesda.
And you've been around 36 years. How big or small is the organization today?
We're about an $8 million organization, 36 staff, 150 faculty. And in terms of scale for this area, that's a fairly substantial music organization.
Right. And when did you become the president and CEO?
9.5 years ago.
How did that come to be?
I had been the chief operating officer at National Public Radio for a number of years and loved it, but left NPR because I was offered an opportunity to start the media practice at KPMG Consulting, which was in the process of going public to become Bearing Point. I realized after I was at KPMG for a year that that really wasn't speaking to me. My calling was more in the nonprofit sector, and I really wanted to do something for the community that I lived in. And I was approached by the headhunter for the Levine School. And initially, I wasn't that interested because I had thought of Levine, you know, as it was 25 years ago before that time. And subsequently, when I was reapproached, I said, this might be something of interest to me. And it proved to be the case.
But you didn't have a music background. What drew you to this particular endeavor?
No, I had a background for many, many years in the nonprofit sector. And funny, at that particular time, I was chairman of the Roundhouse Theater Board of Trustees, and getting involved with Roundhouse and seeing what it could do for Montgomery County was actually more appealing to me than my full-time job with KPMG. I just loved what the nonprofit theater community was doing and how it could serve the residents of the county. So the idea of getting involved in a music school that was serving this entire region was appealing to me. I was always a great appreciator of music. I just was not an extremely talented musician.
Why were, looking back on it, why were you the ideal pick at the time for this role?
I can answer that question in a number of ways, but I think one of the problems the institution had had for a few years is that it had had artists who were running the organization, and they were not very good managers. And they needed somebody who had the business acumen and expertise, as well as the love for the art form, to take it and develop it, and to figure out a way the organization could become solvently. I always say you have to do well before you can do good. And they weren't doing well enough at that time. They were struggling.
Why is this such an important contribution to the community, this school?
Music and music education, no matter what your age, is an extremely important thing for you. And anybody who's ever been involved with music, whether it's on the periphery or directly involved, will echo that thought. If you see would see how music speaks in that particular language to kids ages 4 months to five, sometimes before they read, before they talk, music is speaking to them and teaching them rhythms, tempos, beats. They're learning how to count through music.
Right.
You go into senior facilities, and we have a relationship now with Sunrise Senior Living, and you see how music stimulates people who are having trouble speaking. In fact, there was a story on NPR, which you may or may not have heard, about people who had been catatonic at senior facilities in New York City. And all of a sudden, this guy put an iPod in their ears playing the music of their time. In other words, Cab Calloway, from the 30s or something from the 40s. And all of a sudden, these people who hadn't said a word for days, weeks, in some cases months, were singing songs.
Where do you get your passion from?
I have always had a love of the arts. And I have a love for what the music community, the theater community, the arts community can do. And I think one of my great fears in this day and age is when we start eliminating things because of budgetary constraints. You know, music and the arts are the first to go. Now sports are going.
Right.
We're doing a huge disservice to our children.
So you've always had this love of the arts, always? When you were three? Where did it come from? Where did it originate? Talk to us.
I grew up in New York City, and I remember distinctly when I was 7 or 8 years old, my parents took me to my first Broadway show. And in fact, I saw The Music Man with Robert Preston and Barbara Cook, and it made an indelible impression upon me of these people having such a good time singing this great music with this wonderful orchestra. And it just dazzled me, and I was hooked. You know, I remember going to Little Abner. I remember going to South Pacific. I mean, I was very lucky growing up, near Broadway. I just loved it, and it spoke to me.
So you grew up in New York. Tell us about that experience.
It was fabulous. My father was a purebred New Yorker. I mean, he and my mom grew up in Brooklyn. They moved to Manhattan. My two brothers and I grew up in Manhattan. And one example, an anecdote about my father, is as he got older and infirm, my brothers and I said, "Dad, why don't you move south? You got to go to South Florida somewhere." Because, New York's a tough city to grow old in. And you love golf. Let's get you south. So I'm sitting at my desk, and I remember this distinctly because I was working for a poll at the time. My phone rings. It's my father calling me during the work week. Never happens. He would only call me at night on Mondays, something like that. He calls me. He says, "Pete." And by the way, he's the only person in my life who's ever called me Pete. He says, "Pete, Mom and I have made a decision. We're moving south." I said, "That's fabulous. Where are you going?" He says, "72nd Street.
Say 24th.
Yeah, I mean, he moved from 86 to 76. So I grew up in that environment where New York was the end all. He was in the garment business. My mother's family was in the garment business. And I loved it. I loved the exposure. But I never necessarily wanted to raise my family there.
Yeah. Talk to me about your grandparents. How were you impressed by them?
My grandfather was a gentleman named Maurice Rentner. This is my mother's dad. And he was the dean of 7th Avenue. That was his time. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful man who, we had dinner with him every Friday night. And on Sunday, sometimes he would pick me up and take me when I was 4 or 5 years old to go to Sunday breakfast or lunch with him downtown. He was, by the way, trying to set me up, with meet this lovely girl at age 4 or 5, which I never appreciated till after the fact. But he was just a wonderful, really sweet, wonderful, caring, loving man. I never knew my grandfather or my grandmother that well on my dad's side because they were older, and my grandmother died when I was young, and my grandfather died when I was about 5 on that side.
Do you think those early experiences shaped the way you lead today?
Actually, I think two significant mentors later on in my life shaped me a bit more. I had the greatest experience of working for Abe Poland for 10 years. And then a gentleman named Delano Lewis, who was head of the phone company in Washington, and then he was the CEO at NPR. Those two individuals, I learned more about leadership and management from them. Abe, because he was the nicest, most philanthropic, generous soul I'd ever dealt with in my life. And Dell, because he knew how to engage people in brainstorming, in conversation. He would get everybody together, and you'd have this great think-off of how can we do this? How can we solve this problem? He would make the decision, but he knew how to engage everybody's mind power.
Great. Real quick, what's your proudest moment?
Oh, goodness. I would say the birth of my 3 children, and I guess that's somewhat the cliche answer, but I got to tell you, it's the truth. And my wife of 20-plus years, you know, being married to her is very special. In business, if that's really your question, taking NPR from a $40 million company to a $75 million company in 5 years was very special. You know, taking the Levine School from a struggling enterprise to one of the, you know, top music schools in this country.
Great.
Put those all together.
Great. What's the website address, Peter?
LevineSchool.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Peter Jablow, who is the president and CEO of the Levine School of Music. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Mike Harden.
Mike, who are you with?
I'm with Vistage International.
What is Vistage?
Vistage is by far the largest and probably the most prestigious organization of CEOs in the world. We have about 15,000 members in 16 different countries.
And what does Vistage do?
Vistage is there specifically to help people get better at what they do at the CEO level. Our goal is to help CEOs become better decision makers, to grow their businesses, to do more with what they've got.
And what do you do at Vistage?
Well, I'm a chair with Vistage, and the chair simply means that I chair a local group of chief executive officers, and I coach each of those people individually and try to make myself available to help them with their business needs.
Why is coaching so important to a CEO? Don't they have it all figured out?
I wish they did. I'd been a CEO myself for a long time, and I wish I'd had a coach. There's just too much going on in today's world. You're being pulled in all kinds of different directions. You're making decisions every day, and it's just so isolated for some people to have to make those decisions without the ability to go to other people.
There's a plethora of coaches out there. Why are you a fantastic CEO coach? Why you?
Well, I would say that what I do is I help good CEOs become great CEOs, and what I do with that is I have certain axioms of business that I try to stress, and one of the first ones is that you deserve the people that you hire and keep.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you have A players on your staff, they're going to do a great job for you, and you deserve to have them. If you have B players, well, then you deserve to have B players.
So you're looking for what type of person?
I look for CEOs who are lifelong learners who want to be better at what they do and need someone like me to help them get there.
How do we find you, Mike?
Well, I have a blog, and most CEOs look at it. It's called CEOSuccessCoach.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Harden of Vistage and CEOSuccessCoach.com. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Leo Fox, who's the president and CEO of Tenacity Solutions. What is Tenacity Solutions?
Well, let me start by saying that it is a who is Tenacity Solutions. Tenacity Solutions is an organization of over 125 dedicated professionals that are putting secure information technology solutions into the intelligence community here in the Washington, D.C. area.
So I love your response. What's the difference between what and who?
What infers that it is about the organization. Who would infer that it is about the people? And for us, it's always about the people.
And why is that so important to you?
We're a services firm. It's about getting the best people we can with the appropriate skills and talent and putting them into parts of the organizations in the intel space that they can really make an impactful difference.
Great. When was the organization founded?
Well, it was legally started in 2003, but I would be remiss to tell you that we really started operations in 2004.
Uh-huh. And you're about 120 strong today.
A little over 120 and growing rapidly.
So why start the business?
Matt Wilmoth and myself, who's my partner and a close business colleague, had been with some firms that had been purchased after 9/11, and we decided that it was time to start our own firm, branch out on our own, and build an organization that was really focused on providing the best people into the organizations that we support.
And you have a significant other in the business, is that right?
I do. My lovely bride, Mary, of 25 years.
Uh-huh. And what role does she play?
She is the chairman of the board of the organization and is chiefly responsible for keeping the culture of the organization intact.
Well, when you say chiefly responsible for keeping the culture intact, what do you mean by that?
Again, as a services organization, it's our people that are important, and we wake up every day realizing that those people could choose to go somewhere else. So by keeping a culture that's focused on the employees, giving them the best benefits, the best training opportunities, and the best chance for job advancement, by doing that and keeping the culture fun, we're going to keep those employees.
We'll get back to the complications of having a spouse in the business, but where are you from, Leo?
Originally from Belmont, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston.
And what was growing up in that neighborhood like?
It was a lot of fun. You know, growing up in a real strong Irish-Italian community and getting the opportunity to live in a duplex beneath my grandparents, really, it was a lot of fun.
I'll say a little more about that.
It was great, principally because we really had the opportunity of having my grandparents there to help raise us. And my grandfather really was probably the person that imprinted on me the desire to be an entrepreneur. He had his own shoe shop, got up bright and early every morning. We saw him going off to work. We'd get back from school every day. We'd be studying and having dinner, and we'd see him walking home from work. So he really was what made me who I am today.
Leo, I understand you went to the Citadel in Charleston. What took you there?
Again, as I think we chatted earlier, it was temporary insanity that drove me to the Citadel. I didn't really have an appreciation for the difference between growing up in Boston and going to college in Charleston, South Carolina. They are different worlds.
How? Other than the obvious.
Other than the obvious. There is a real divide in those cultures that I really didn't have an appreciation for, but it was something that really drew me, especially to the Citadel, where there was the real history of the military school and the regiment that went through that, and really drove me to study and do well and get out of school and carry that forward into my professional career.
Yeah. So how do you suppose that experience shaped you, looking back on it?
It was probably the organization that really beat into me the desire to want to be a leader, and not about that it's not about management, but it's about leadership.
And what is it about leadership that's different than management?
It's the creating of a vision and following that vision and bringing people along with you to capture that.
Mm-hmm. What did you do after college?
After I graduated from the Citadel, ended up going to work at CIA for a number of years, a little short of 10 years. Exciting time during the Reagan administration. To be part of that organization was really a blessing.
And why did you leave government?
I believe in my heart it became a desire to want to chase the entrepreneurial spirit that was kind of deep inside me that I didn't realize was there, but came through.
Uh-huh. What was the most difficult part about starting the company?
Probably getting that first contract was the real difficult part, but it was never a lack of faith that was going to happen. My wife tells me that I had blind faith at the beginning that it was going to happen and that we were going to get the right people and we were going to be successful. So it wasn't a question of whether we were going to do it. It was how quickly we were going to do it.
Yeah. How did your wife come to be a part of the business?
She was, and continues to be for me, kind of my rock. She centers me, and I can bounce ideas off her. So she's kind of the person that has brought me back to focus in on what's important.
Say a little bit more about that, though. How did she come to be in the business?
So myself and many of the folks in the organization are very, very technically focused. That is the skill set that we bring. Mary's skill set through her professional career has always been on the personnel, HR, recruiting side. So she was able to bring that mindset with her to help us as we started the organization up.
In the early days, how tough was it to recruit really good talent?
Early on, not too hard. We were obviously constrained by how much cash we had to bring folks on. So it was friends and family at first, mm-hmm. and we brought them on as we could afford to bring them on.
How do you know you have really good talent in front of you that you want to hire?
You can see it in their eye, whether there's the burning passion to want to get in and take care of a customer and do what it takes to really make them happy and make them successful. And when I hear back from our customers that folks that others didn't think were great, but we saw something special and delivered those folks, it really is, really makes my day.
Mm. How do you spend the bulk of your day now?
The bulk of my day is, my folks at Harvard Business School would applaud me. It's working on the business, not in the business. I would tell you many years, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I spent a lot of my time in helping the customer, working on project on a day-to-day. But today, 90% of my job is spent working with our business partners, the attorneys, the bankers, the folks that are providing our health care and various benefits, and the training of our staff is where the majority of my day is spent.
Yeah. What were you like as a kid?
I'm glad my mother's not here to answer that question. I was the middle child of three boys, so I was always the one that was getting in trouble. Both my brothers are still up in Boston, not too far from my mother. I was the one that went away for college. I was the one that moved out of the area to go to school, so I was the one that was always wandering away from the pack.
How about Mom and Dad? What were they doing growing up?
Dad worked at the bank in Boston his entire life, so we grew up knowing that Dad was walking down the street to catch the bus and would come home every evening. It was.
How do you suppose that experience shaped you?
It gave me the stability to know that, and the confidence that I know that whatever I did, that my family was there to support me. I never had the sense that were any of my failings to be significant, that they were always going to be there to be that safety net for me, which was comforting.
You've mentioned several times that the culture is the key. It's the people. How would you describe the culture of your company?
We've got very much a work hard, play hard mentality, and that is in everything we do, from working hard with our customers, working hard on proposals to support our customers, and working hard for our staff that has passions such as supporting scouting organizations, coaching various athletic organizations, mission trips for churches that our folks go to. We tend to use the strength of the organization and the funds of the organizations to help those folks, to kind of give it a multiplying effect so that we can really make an impact.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
I would suggest the toughest thing was starting the business, just that first step.
Okay.
There was never a lack of confidence, but it was that first step when you go meet with the attorneys and sign the papers to start it up. You kind of do a big gulp. It's not a lack of confidence. It's just an oh, wow moment.
Was there a moment where you knew we're there, we're going to succeed?
I think that happened when we won our first contract.
Uh-huh. What did that feel like?
It was indescribable. The facts came across that said we had won the contract, and myself and several of us that were in the room read it 3 or 4 times and were in disbelief.
If I was interviewing your grandfather, would he be surprised at your success?
Not at all.
What would he say?
Not at all. He would have said he knew all along.
If you were here with him, what would you want to tell him right now?
That I love him and miss him. The easy ones, but to thank him for everything he did for me. He was, as a shoe cobbler that had a small shop, he was the guy that invested in IBM in the early 60s or when it first started, and that's where my college fund was paid for out of. So he was that guy that took a risk to do things.
Great. How about your proudest moment up till now, Leo?
I think my proudest moment up to now was dropping my oldest daughter off to start her freshman year of college.
Wonderful. When was that?
Just 9 months ago. So she's home for the summer now. So
congratulations. And what's the website address?
The website is www.tenacitysolutions.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Leo Fox, who's the president and CEO of Tenacity Solutions. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license. And that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker has a is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by David Taylor from the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young lady by the name of Suzanne Jackson, who's the CEO of Dominion Hospital. What is Dominion Hospital, Suzanne?
Dominion Hospital is a 100-bed freestanding mental health facility in Falls Church, Virginia, where we service children, adolescents, and adults who suffer from mental illness. So that can include anorexia, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder. We have a day treatment program as well. And we also have the only dedicated eating disorders unit in the state of Virginia.
There are so many misconceptions out there about mental illness. Help clear one up for us.
I think most people think it's not someone they know, but everyone has there's a lot of people who suffer from mental illness, and one in four, I believe, is the statistic. So it can be your boss, your coworker, your child, your mother, your neighbor, your pastor. Everybody has it doesn't look like what you think it looks like.
Right. You were giving us some examples in the green room about the kinds of events and things that can lead up to an mm-hmm. event. Tell us a little bit about that.
Newly diagnosed cancer. Someone can be depressed from that. A mother during childbirth losing her child could be suffering from postpartum depression. You could have an adolescent who's being bullied at school for various reasons. You can have a child who may have been abused or suffering from abandonment issues from being adopted.
Right.
Could be an older person who is now the only person left in their family and all their friends have passed away. Right. So there's so many different scenarios that one could be suffering.
Yeah. When did you become the CEO?
I became the CEO in November of 2007 after moving up here from Florida. I was in the Miami area for about 5 years with our parent company, another hospital, HCA, Hospital Corporation of America. And that was before I moved down there from Chicago, or Skokie, which is a north suburb of Chicago.
Is that where you're from?
I'm from Skokie, Illinois.
So what was it like growing up in Skokie, Illinois?
It was really interesting growing up in Skokie, Illinois. It was a predominantly Jewish area, and I am a biracial product of my father is from Haiti, immigrant, and my mother was a white Jewish lady who was born in Chicago her whole entire life, probably second generation from Europe.
Wow. So how do you suppose that experience of having those kinds of parents shaped you?
In multiple ways. I believe growing up Jewish but having appreciation for other cultures and celebrating my father's culture and his family coming over, celebrating Christmas and Easter, but also realizing we celebrated Hanukkah. So I would grow up, and in our picture, we had two picture windows. One would have the Christmas tree with all the presents, and then we'd have the menorah in the other window. And it was great because for 8 days for Hanukkah, I got a gift. And then on Christmas, I also got gifts. So it was really pretty fun as a kid growing up.
How did you find yourself in healthcare?
I think there's a lot of different situations that brought me towards healthcare. In the green room, when I was talking to Melissa after everyone left, I thought about it. I was like, from the earliest I can remember, I wanted to be a singing, acting doctor. And then I was young and I thought I could do everything. But then I volunteered at the local hospital and realized I don't like death and I don't like needles or blood. So that patient care wasn't really going to be for me. So I said, I'm good at math and science. I'm going to be an engineer. So I was going to be a biomedical engineer. I was still going to help people because I was going to make prosthetics. And then I went to college and got into the classes and realized my personality probably wasn't best suited for that particular career. Went to the Career Center, which is what you would expect from me. I like data. I use data to make decisions. And I took an exam and it came up with 8 professions. And I called my dad. I said, hospital administrator, what does that do? He's like, those are the people in charge at the hospital. And that's what you need to do. I did an internship and I changed my major. And I've always been focused on healthcare from that point on.
What were you like as a kid?
I guess my mom probably could answer that better. However, based on the stories and things that she says, I was very focused. Some might have called me a little bossy, but I was always in charge and I like to coordinate things. And I remember Mrs. Gam was my first teacher that I really felt took advantage of my outspokenness and used it in a positive way, and I became her teacher's helper, and my desk was next to hers. Probably thinking back, she probably was trying to keep me in control, but I was like, I am in charge. I got to hand out the test. I actually also started a little business, and I had one of the guys was working for me, and people could buy pencils and pens and erasers. And then the money I got from everybody, then I could buy treats for the classroom. I remember she allowed me to do that, and it was funny. And now I'm thinking about it as we're talking. That was my first employee.
How did you come to be the CEO? I know it was a transition into the DC area, but why? Well, how about this? Why were you the ideal pick?
I believe that I was the ideal pick, and obviously, I would say my boss is probably the best to speak to it. But from what I can gather, I think I was the ideal pick because I walked into the organization open to learning about the organization, learning from the staff, and saying, okay, can we do things differently? Can we have a different focus than we've had before? How do I leverage everybody's talents that's here? Because I don't necessarily know and I don't have all the answers. And I need you to share with me your expertise and how we can make this the best place for not only for people to work and for the doctors to practice, but for the patients to have the most positive experience and leave here better than they came.
Did there come a time, you said you were originally going into biomedical engineering. Did
Yes.
there come a time when you decided it was more important to help people rather than to make things to help people?
Yes. I would say that when my father got sick with liver cancer, it was terminal. But what happened is he ended up living longer, and we had to keep justifying why, you know, that he's actually terminal. And I saw the challenges my family had, financial and just stress around constantly having to convey this story and provide proof that we were having dealing with this difficult situation. And at that time, I realized I needed to be in a position where I could impact change and make sure that there's policies that help people and think about people's experiences.
How do you reconcile this advocacy mm-hmm. piece of you and the requirement by the organization to do well financially?
Quite frankly, I think it goes hand in hand, right? Because at my hospital, I have over 200 employees. Every decision I make impacts their livelihood. If I make the wrong decision, whether it be financial or whether it be political, it impacts them. We have to figure out how to provide cost effective quality care so that people have a job to come to, so people have a hospital to receive care when they're in need. I mean, it's all connected to one another.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
I would say at this point in my career, and I have a lot ahead of me, so I'm sure if you ask me 20 years from now, it would be different. But right now, the toughest thing I've had to accomplish is transforming a culture in an organization that felt like it was being underled. It was they felt neglected. They didn't feel like they were being cared about. And I came in to let them know that that's not the situation, that you are important to this company and you're important to the community and you're important to the over 2,000 and so people that we help every day.
How about your proudest moment up till now?
Well, my proudest moment? I just had my second daughter. So for me, I would say that that's been my proud. Watching Taylor's two and Zoe's 6 months. So watching the developmental milestones has been really amazing. And quite frankly, I believe has impacted my leadership style in that I not only am I a little bit more patient with people, but I believe that I have more compassion for people.
I know your father's no longer with us, but mm-hmm. Would he be surprised at your success?
No, there was an expectation.
It was.
It was an expectation for me to be successful, but I think that he would be thrilled because and any person who has immigrant parents would feel that they come here, they want a better life for their child, and they make sacrifices, and I believe that I use that to continue to push myself, and he would be very happy to see that.
Great. Suzanne, what's the website address?
www.dominionhospital.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Suzanne Jackson, who's the CEO of Dominion Hospital. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me structure the interviews today. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show, including Joseph Kampf, who is the chairman and CEO of a company called Covant. We have Peter Jablow, who's the president and CEO of Levine School of Music, Leo Fox, the president and CEO of Tenacity Solutions, Inc., and finally, Suzanne Jackson, the CEO of Dominion Hospital. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
Did you know Federal News Radio can also be heard on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland? Check it out the next time you head to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor. Tune in to Federal News Radio for the latest news and information about the federal government and the federal contracting world. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Want the latest Department of Defense news? Listen every Wednesday for DoD Wednesday on Federal News Radio. Wednesday afternoons at 2, Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. Then stick around Wednesday afternoons at 3 when in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a deep dive into the issues and challenges of the defense community. All this plus our daily DoD updates at 40 past the hour, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Federal News Radio in a Web 2.0 world. Find Federal News Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio group on Facebook. Chat with our team and make connections with others in the federal arena. Email us at fnrcomment@federalnewsradio.com. Visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
As a manager, you need to know how you can make your organization more efficient. Listen for Management Friday on Federal News Radio. We bring you information on the keystone of success for any agency or business. Friday mornings at 10, listen for AFGE's perspective on inside government. Next at 11, Shaw, Bransford, and Roth talk about the legal implications of management decisions on Fed Talk. And at noon, listen for Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch. Management Friday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.